You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new Wisconsin job numbers show lower unemployment and a significant number of new jobs added. We look at what type of jobs they are and if wages are going up.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news, the Wisconsin News Roundup.
The owners of the Milwaukee Bucks have agreed to a 30-year lease agreement with the owners of the team's future arena.
Federal judges decided voters who face major difficulties getting a voter ID may be able to vote without one. And the girls charged in the Slender Man case have asked to be released.
Robert Menser joins us now. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Let's start off with this Milwaukee Bucks agreement. The Bucks organization has signed a 30-year lease agreement on their new stadium. This has been was a political issue big time in that last state budget. What are the details of this new contract?
Yeah, so this is finally finalized this week, and a 30-year lease is a long time. So the Bucks are really, really, really officially staying in Milwaukee, and I think that's a sigh of relief for a lot of the Bucks fans. The team will pay over $1 million a year, around $1.5 million per year in rent to the Wisconsin Center District in Milwaukee, a total of $45 million over the lease of the term. And that was finalized Wednesday. So it opens the door for construction to begin maybe in, they're hoping to have a groundbreaking in June and maybe start playing by the fall of 2018.
And part of this agreement is something that says, hey, you guys can't leave. At least you can't leave without consequences. What kind of penalties are there?
Yeah, pretty heavy penalties. I think that you'd have to think twice about it. The financial penalties are $550 million if the Bucks do decide to leave early. So I think that if they're going to get wooed by Seattle or somewhere, they're going to have to really cough up a lot of money. The overall cost of the project has gone up. It was they used to say it was estimated to be only a mere $500 million for this project, and now it's at $524 million in the final version. As I've been telling all my friends in Milwaukee, that I hope they enjoy their new stadium paid for by my tax dollars.
Well, let's get into our tax dollars. How is the state and then the county and city of Milwaukee kicking in?
Yeah, so the public funding is all told is about $250 million for the project. As you alluded to, a major political football during the budget process.
Political basketball, please, Rob. Political basketball.
political basketball. That's a common phrase, right? So it ended up being kicked out of the state budget there was an argument that is this really the best way to get return on tax dollars, but at any rate, I mean, it went through, and it's very popular in Milwaukee, and there's a lot of people in Milwaukee, so they're very pleased to have their basketball team.
And a lot of effort to build economic development around this thing, and other uses for the arena itself and the surrounding development.
Sure, and they expect to have concerts and other things. And there is certainly a tourist value. The sort of economic argument, I mean, there is an argument against it. A lot of economists will say that there is opportunity cost, that this money used in other sorts of economic development projects may do better. And that's a common argument around sports arenas. But on the other hand, sports are very popular, and so it's also a losing argument in the political arena.
Talking about some of the top news stories of the week with Rob Menser from the USA Today Network, Wisconsin. Well, another political basketball, Rob, that's been bouncing on a long time, Wisconsin's voter ID law. I thought all the court challenges had been sorted out, but nope, here comes one more this week that's not done yet, is moving forward this week, though.
Right. So ever since 2011, this is a bouncing political basketball. So it's been blocked. It's been reinstated different times, different judges. And after this year's April primary, it was seen as the first big test of the law, the first time that it was in effect in an election with a lot of people voting. So sort of perhaps a surprise that there is one last legal challenge remaining. Now, it is very narrow. There were some of the earlier challenges that ended up being shot down were much broader claims that the law broadly disenfranchises people of color or other sort of classes of voters who are specifically protected by the Voting Rights Act. This claim doesn't do that. This claim is about the specific people who don't have access to a state ID and for various complicated reasons can't get them without paying a fee. And it's a poll tax is unconstitutional. You can't charge someone to vote. An example of this, back in 2011, I interviewed an elderly woman named Ruthel Frank of Brokaw, Wisconsin, who was born at home, had no birth certificate, and her name, her last name, was misspelled in the state registry. So it actually costs money to get that state registry corrected. So in order for her to get the birth certificate she would need to get the state ID that she would need to vote, she would have to pay money. So it's sort of like, this is not a common occurrence, but it's a constitutional right. Ruthel Frank has a right to vote. So this is the specific challenge that is moved forward is people in a situation like that where they, for whatever, reasons, don't have the documents and don't have a way to get them for free.
Now, a federal court gave the go-ahead to hear this case, but this is not an existential threat to the voter ID law, as I understand it. It's not something, unless some court goes really far beyond what anybody expects, it's not going to overturn the law. The most, and correct me if I'm wrong, it would do is say, okay, for these very specific cases, you, Wisconsin, have to remedy that. Do I have that right?
Right. So maybe they could vote if they have a legal affidavit, they'd be allowed to cast a ballot. I suppose there's sort of a fantasy world version. Let's not give it too short shrift. We have a new U.S. Supreme Court justice seated. There's a new U.S. Supreme Court with a liberal majority. They decide to hear this narrow little case, and they use it to strike down the entire voter ID law. Now, that's really not going to happen. I think that's pretty unlikely. But I mean, it's theoretically possible. And I suppose that the sort of opponents of voter ID, liberal opponents, would rather there be something, some challenge alive than not.
Any idea of a timeline on this legal challenge?
Oh, who knows? the federal courts will do what they're going to do, I suppose.
Well, moving on to another story, the two teens accused of stabbing, attempted murder on their schoolmate, based on the fictional Slender Man online character, the so-called Slender Man case, this thing is still in the courts. They and their lawyers are making movement to get them released from custody. What's the latest in that story?
Yeah, so this was just today, just a little bit earlier today, was this petition was denied. This is a disturbing case. As you say, it's about 2 years old. It happened May 31st, 2014. Two 12-year-old girls from Waukesha County lured a friend into the woods, stabbed her 19 times, left her to die. She survived when she was found by a bicyclist who was passing by in that area. So, a bizarre story that became more bizarre as we learned that these girls had done so to convince this fictional sort of internet myth character named Slender Man, who they believed they would go and live with in a castle in the forest in northern Wisconsin. So one of these girls, now 13, has been diagnosed with schizophrenia. That's very rare in someone this young, but it's not unheard of. And in this legal filing, her lawyers argued that treatment for schizophrenia has stabilized her, and that it would be safe for her and good for her to go and live with her grandparents in Waukesha County. Both girls also petitioned to have the amount of their bail, $500,000 in bail, reduced. That was declined today. They're both being charged as adults with first degree intentional homicide. But there's still a chance that their cases could end up being transferred to juvenile court. That is one of many things that is still ongoing in this case.
And Rob, before we're done, apart from the specific details of this case, this has raised questions about trying youth juveniles in adult court, especially starting at an age as young as 12.
For sure, and add in some hard questions about mental illness. So can a mentally ill 12-year-old, to what extent can she be held accountable for actions that she took, even quite horrifying, quite extremely violent actions? It's a hard question to think through, and it's I think shocking. The girls' names, their pictures are broadcast throughout the news media, and it is shocking to see girls so young, both involved in such a shocking case, but also being treated in exactly the way of that adults would be in a similar case.
We'll leave it there for now. Thanks for joining us today, Rob.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer with USA Today Network Wisconsin, recapping the biggest headlines around the state in our Wisconsin News Roundup. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the host of the NPR show On Being joins us for a look at how to become wise.
First, the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development just released new state job numbers, drawing from U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. The number looks positive at first glance. The state unemployment rate in March fell to 4.5%, below the national average by half a percentage point, and over 47,000 private sector jobs were added between March 2015 and last month. That pushed total employment in Wisconsin to more than 3 million, an all-time high.
And a new national report from the U.S. Labor Department saw the lowest number of new jobless claims since 1973.
So a lot of positive indicators, but some economists are saying a closer look might show some lingering worries. Joining us now to analyze the latest numbers is Abdur Chaudhry. He's a professor of economics at Marquette University. Professor Chaudhry, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me on your program. Thank you.
So this 4.5% unemployment number here in Wisconsin, lower than the national average, but this is pretty good news. This is a low unemployment number, something that generally we'd be happy about, right?
Yes. Overall, I think the labor market, both at the national as well as the state level, is doing very well. Most of the labor market indicators are quite positive, and it shows that there has been significant improvement in the last couple of months at least.
When it comes to wages, though, people have been watching a long time, especially in the recovery from the Great Recession. Job numbers keep looking okay, but are wages starting to go up now?
It hasn't, unfortunately, and that's one of the main concerns we have of the labor market. So what is happening is we are creating a lot of jobs, both at the national and state level, but most of these jobs are in low-paying, low-skilled areas. In hospitality, for example, in leisure, we are not creating enough high-paying, high-skilled jobs in manufacturing and construction. As a result, we do see a sort of a flat wage growth rate in the U.S. as well as in Wisconsin.
Do we start to hit a point, though, when unemployment numbers get low enough, when employment is high enough, that even those lower-paid jobs, there's so few workers available out there, their wages start to creep up?
And that's what we are hoping is going to happen. Hopefully, maybe later this year, once the labor market continues to tighten, you will see jobs being created in those high-paying areas, and that will push the wage rate upward.
I want to look at this U.S. Labor Department number, looking at new jobless claims in the week ending April 9th, the lowest level since November 1973. So that seems surprising to me that we'd be at that level. Is that as good news as it sounds like?
It is good news. And usually the rule of thumb that we use is as long as the number is below 300,000, we say that, it's good for the labor market. And the number, as you said, is the lowest we have seen in almost, 40 years. So it's good news for the labor market.
As we look around Wisconsin, can we say the state as a whole is doing pretty good when it comes to unemployment? Or do we have pockets where one area is doing really well, another area is doing poorly?
State-wise, I would say metropolitan areas are doing much better over the last couple of months, especially Milwaukee, the Madison area. They're doing quite well. If you look at the suburbs of Milwaukee, we have seen significant job creation in those areas. So the metropolitan areas are doing much better than, let's say, the rural areas.
I want to bring in another statistic now, what some people call, I think, the workforce participation rate. This is how many people who could be working are actually working or looking for work. And what can happen there sometimes is we see the unemployment go down, and it's bad news because people have given up. They're disappointed, they're dispirited, and they stop looking. Sometimes the unemployment rate goes up, and it's good news because those people are seeing the potential for jobs. They're getting back in the market. So what are we seeing with that in Wisconsin and around the country?
With the labor force participation rate, that was a concern we had. After the Great Recession, we did see that participation rate drop by a couple of percentage points. Now, over the last several months, that has started to pick up. For example, the latest figures that we have nationally, the participation rate is around 63%, which is reasonably good. And another positive thing, at least at the national level, is as you have seen last month, unemployment rate sort of went up a little bit from 4.9% to 5%. But I think that has happened for the right reason. More people has entered the labor market, about 400,000 new entries into the labor market. So that's good news.
Talking to economics professor Abdur Chaudhry from Marquette University, looking at job numbers in Wisconsin and around the country. A couple different reports came out this week, pointing toward good news, showing unemployment going down, total number of jobs going up. So Abdur, we've gotten into a lot of the what the numbers are. Let's start to look at the why. Why are we seeing these positive signs, more jobs, less unemployment, more people getting back in the game, getting back in the job market?
One of the reasons for that is if you look at the U.S. economy overall, now obviously there are some weak points here and there, but overall we are doing relatively well compared to, let's say, our trading partners in Western Europe. So with the pickup in the economy, we do see more jobs being created across the board. For example, take the housing sector. It was in, you know, we had a lot of problem with the housing sector in the past. But over the last 2 years, we have seen new construction sort of going up in the housing sector. So, and that is true for a number of other sectors across the economy. So we do see an willingness on the part of the employers to start hiring more people.
And we've seen stories since really when the Great Recession was still in effect and through the recovery, the idea that big companies and banks, too, were sitting on money for a long time. Big companies seeing things uncertain, didn't want to invest in new projects, factories, whatever, and new hires. Banks a little shy about lending money, all because they were uncertain about how this economy, how the recovery was going to go. So are these numbers we're seeing now a sign that they're starting to say, okay, we don't need to keep this cash reserve, we can start investing again?
There is some indication that that might be happening, but still, we do have a lot of cash on the sideline. Many corporations have decided not to repatriate their profit from overseas. That is there. But still, we do see, especially small and medium-sized companies, they have started to increase their hiring. And that is good news because if you look at the U.S., small and medium-sized enterprises, they account for about 70% of the job creation. So once they decide to start hiring, that's good news for the overall economy.
I saw this article in The Economist I wanted to kind of throw at you here, a cover story making the case that American corporate profits are really high, and that's actually bad news. It means that a lot of the big money-making companies are just coasting. They're able to charge high prices. New competitors aren't merging. We're not seeing the natural sort of ebb and flow of the market with new people under, you know, disrupting, prices not going down as a result. But what do you make of that idea?
That is true to some extent, especially that I would say that would be true more for the big corporations in the U.S. Their profit level, you'll see, has increased manifold, whereas for the small and medium-sized businesses, that's not very true. Their profit has not increased at the same level. So I would say what you said holds for the large corporations.
A lot of people watching the Federal Reserve wondering if and when they're going to raise rates. They've been hesitant. They keep some rate increases in the works, but they've kept saying, we don't know if this recovery is going strong enough for us to really raise rates too much more. What are you looking for from them?
As you know, the Federal Reserve Reserve Bank is supposed to meet later this month, and my guess at this point is that they're not going to raise interest rates in April. One of the reasons for that, some of the recent numbers that came out are a little bit weak. For instance, the retail sales figure for March, we saw 0.3% drop. Also, the inflation numbers came out yesterday. It's not where the Fed would like to see. So I would say if the Fed raises interest rate, it's not going to happen before their June meeting.
Bottom line for American workers and consumers, what kind of things are you watching for to see if wages are going to go up, if people can afford those American dream basics, buying a house or renting, going to college, that sort of thing?
Going forward, my view is that for the first quarter of 2016, the U.S. economy, if you look at the GDP growth rate, it's not going to be too high, somewhere in the 1% to 1.5% range. But moving forward in the second and third quarter, we do expect to see some pickup in GDP. The housing market will also pick up with the weather improving. You will see housing market picking up. You will see some improvement in manufacturing. I think that things will start getting better in the second half of 2016.
I'm sure we'll talk to you about that when it happens. Professor Chaudhry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me on your program. Thank you.
That's Abdur Chaudhry, professor of economics at Marquette University. He explained what new state and federal job numbers mean for us here in Wisconsin.
Coming up, the host of the NPR show On Being joins us to talk about the lessons she's learned from How to Become Wise. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up with less than a week to go before the New York primary, national frontrunners Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are leading and are expected to regain their momentum. We'll get more tonight after 7 with the political junkie Ken Rudin here on the Ideas Network.
In a few moments, some advice on being wise. First, Wisconsin life. The Niagara Escarpment stretches from New York to Wisconsin and shapes the geological, environmental, and human history of all that it touches. Like the escarpment, writer Robert Root's life stretches from New York to Wisconsin. In honor of upcoming Earth Day, he shares his connection to this geologic wonder.
Synchronicity happens to everyone. Carl Jung called it a meaningful coincidence, with no evident causal connection, but some apparent significance. Not everyone who notices a synchronicity is haunted by it. But one that haunts me persistently centers on the Niagara Escarpment. The Niagara Escarpment's most prominent feature is Niagara Falls, but as a geological formation, the escarpment arcs all the way from western New York, across western Ontario and northern Michigan, down through eastern Wisconsin. All of the land and all of the Great Lakes within the arc rest on Silurian strata, from which escarpment outcroppings emerge. Increase Lapham, Wisconsin's pioneer scientist, recognized the connection early from having helped excavate the Erie Canal in Lockport, New York, before finding the same strata in Wisconsin later on. The Niagara Escarpment, or the ledge, is visible on Rock Island in state and county parks like Peninsula and Pottawatomie and High Cliff, and for those looking for it, as far south as Brady's Rocks in Waukesha County. For me, that's where synchronicity comes into play. Like Lapham, I began in western New York. Born and raised in Lockport, like Lapham, I'll end in Waukesha County. Unlike him, I spent the middle of my life in Michigan, often visiting the Upper Peninsula unaware of walking on the escarpment. The idea that the escarpment and I begin and end in the same places is the synchronicity I can't get out of my mind. On the Eagle segment of the Ice Age Trail, you pass through oak savanna and low wetlands before you reach the loop for Brady's Rocks. You walk beneath century-old oaks and gaze at the largest wet prairie east of the Mississippi. If the wind drowns out distant traffic sounds and you look across swaying grasses stretching in the distance, you can imagine how Michael and Kathleen Brady saw it for the first time when they began to farm here in 1855. Remnants of a stone rubble fence are all that remains of their farm. Outcroppings of stone that perch on the side of a slope are the most exposed natural evidence of the Niagara Escarpment in the county. If you're looking for a place to witness the end or the beginning of the arc of the escarpment, this is the place to come. Ice Age Trail volunteers maintain the Brady's Rocks Loop. There you pass between rock formations often shoulder height, head height, and higher. Random blocks of stone coated in thick coverings of moss, large freestanding blocks and short towers, and then a continuous wall of exposed stone. Amid abundant undergrowth, you find distinctive ferns, cliff break, fragile fern, and the intriguing walking fern, which grows a new fern when a leaf tip touches wet ground and thus walks across its habitat. The Brady's Rocks Loop has a kind of intimate seclusion, made more intimate and more secluded by the way the rocks obscure the view as you walk among them. Each time I walk among Brady's Rocks, I'm haunted by synchronicity. Here, the Niagara Escarpment and I both end, I think. It's made me start to walk the escarpment all the way back to the Erie Canal, headed back to where we both began.
Robert Root is the author of the forthcoming book, Walking Home Ground, Time, Terrain, Transition, and Other Books. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton.
Our next guest has made it her life's work to gather wisdom from some of the world's deepest thinkers. As the Peabody Award-winning host of the NPR show On Being, she's interviewed everyone from spiritual leaders like the Dalai Lama and Bishop Desmond Tutu to physicist Brian Greene and civil rights leader John Lewis.
Now she's collected what she's learned over the years in her new book, Becoming Wise. Krista Tippett joins us now. Krista, welcome to Central Time.
I'm so glad to be with you.
Well, there's a great quote from the poet Rilke that you talk about in your book, and it gets at the question of how to live the questions of life and learning to love those questions instead of looking always for the answers or finding those answers. What big questions do you think that we have to consider as human beings?
Right now, well, I think that a real hallmark of this moment we're in, culturally, nationally, and globally, is great big open questions. And, things, basic aspects of life and of our life together that we kind of thought we'd figured out in the 20th century, definitions of life and death and gender and marriage. And also our technology is kind of turning all of our institutions inside out, because we're revisiting the meaning of things like authority and leadership and community and making and belonging. Human beings are we're pretty well equipped when we have a clear crisis and a clear enemy, and sometimes we cope by creating a sense of an enemy. But right now there are a lot of questions we have to live forward, because as Rilke said, we can't live the answers yet in ways we're all going to agree. So this, in my mind, is kind of calling us to finding new ways to live with our differences and still be in relationship to each other.
And it's interesting, when you talk about some of these big fundamental questions of life, you might think, well, Krista Tippett's going to be talking to people from various religions, theologians. But you do say that, for instance, scientists are some of your favorite people to talk to about big questions. How come?
Yes. I actually think that physicists and neuroscience and biologists in this century are actually walking some of the ground that philosophers and theologians walked have traditionally held. These questions of what it means to be human and how we want to live, in that realm of neuroscience, we are understanding our bodies and brains in a way that is completely new, and with all kinds of knowledge that I think can be a form of power for us to attempt to rise to our best selves. I think that scientists, physicists, people working with the cosmos, are opening up our perspective on ourselves in a new way. And this is happening whether whether these scientists are setting out to explore spiritual questions or not, it's like, you know, their discoveries have these really important moral and spiritual kind of resonance and implications.
Well, speaking of scientists, there's a quote from Einstein that you like. He said that he was looking more toward geniuses in the art of living. The phrase geniuses in the art of living. Do you think you've met people who could be described like that?
I do. You know, Einstein believed in his life for a long time that science could be this realm that transcended tribal rivalries and called humanity to its best self. And then he watched physicists and chemists in his age become creators of mass destruction, of weapons of mass destruction. And he looked at figures like Gandhi, who was his contemporary, and Jesus and Moses and Buddha and St. Francis of Assisi. And he said, these are geniuses. Spiritual geniuses, geniuses in the art of living. So I have been pursuing that idea. I love that idea. But I think what has become so important to me and what I really, really pursued as I wrote the book is not just the spiritual geniuses of the ages, those great figures who come to mind, you know, also Martin Luther King Jr., Mother Teresa, Dorothy Day, but spiritual geniuses of the everyday. And my experience is that these lives that illuminate and bring compassion and beauty and hospitality to the spaces they can see and touch, that these lives are everywhere, and that kind of wisdom and spiritual genius is available to all of us. It's not just something for saints and for famous figures.
Well, your book is your own experience and what you've gone through over the years, but it's also highlighting some of these everyday geniuses that you talk to on your radio show. Who's an example of someone who you think is someone you wouldn't think might illuminate the life, the world for the rest of us, but did for you and for other people?
Oh, you know, I could just think about interviews I've done very recently, an indie rock band called Cloud Cult, which is our podcast for this week, which is a wonderful band. They make wonderful music, and they had a really cathartic experience in the early years of the band when the sec 2-year-old son of the singer songwriter, the founder, died mysteriously in his sleep. And you know, they as parents and as a group walked through loss and made music around that experience and what they were making of it, and you know, encountered that there is a world of loss out there. And you know, I interview poets and I interview, you know, as you say, physicists and neuroscientists, and there are these most unexpected ways to come at this part of life and illuminate it. You know, and one of the most important lessons, you know, to come back to Cloud Cult, to this band, is that, in fact, we become wise and we become courageous through the way we walk through what goes wrong, as much as anything else. That, you know, the ordinary elements of our lives, the words we speak, the physicality of our presence in the world, how we relate to our loved ones, but also to strangers, how we walk through what's not what we wish it to be. This is the breeding ground of wisdom. And I find it in all kinds of places and all kinds of ages of people.
Krista Tippett is with us now. She's the host of the NPR show On Being. Her new book is called Becoming Wise, and we're talking about how to live the big questions in life when you don't have all the answers.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Where do you look for this kind of inspiration? Who inspires you? Who helps you become wise? Do you think we're moving toward a world that brings things like science and spirituality together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and Krista Tippett is with us now. She's the host of the NPR show On Being, and her new book is called Becoming Wise. And we're talking about how to live the big questions in life, maybe when we don't have the answers. And Krista, you left off saying that we learn as much from these parts of our lives that aren't going so well as we do from the rest of our lives. And I wonder about some of your personal experience that you write about in the book. You write about going through periods of serious depression. How did that inform your view of the world and the job that you do on the radio today.
Yeah, well, I always think when you're talking about something like depression, it's really dangerous to say, to say to some, especially when there, if there may be people listening who are in the middle of that, you know, that this will be good for you. That's not my message. But I think the truth is that all the dark places and the different infinite variety of that in human experience are also, you know, when we're broken in some way, we also are broken open. You know, what would break us often become those passages that also make us who we are. That and so that was certainly true for me of depression. It's not something I would have chosen. It's not something I'd wish on anyone. But it was for me a moment of having to face a lot of things in my past, some ways that I had survived that were really hard on me. And so I came to know myself better, and including my ragged edges. And I think, you know, I don't think of healing or wholeness as so much overcoming those things as integrating them into your sense of wholeness. I don't know. One of my favorite, I think one of the wisest people I know is a yoga teacher named Matthew Sanford, who's in the book, who's also been paralyzed since he was 14 from the waist down. And, you know, for him, I think, you know, he is healing and healed without being fixed. And that's a wonderful way for all of us to think about, you know, claiming as part of our wholeness the things that are not perfect. And we all have those things.
As we wrap up, I want to ask you about something you said in the book about one of the real luminaries that you talked to. Obviously, there were many of them, from names we've heard to names we haven't. Mm-hmm. But you did get to spend time with the Bishop Desmond Tutu, and yes. And you said you found him impossible to doubt. Why was that? What was that experience like?
Well, Desmond Tutu, yeah, of course, is extraordinary, and he is. I would say he has a quality that is true of all the wisest people I've sat with, and it's a physical presence. Is, you know, it's not merely spiritual. It is physical. It transmits itself. I mean, you know, Desmond Tutu told me that God has a sense of humor. And I think that line, when Desmond Tutu tells you something about God, you're sitting with him, you believe him. And, you know, in his person, like other people I've interviewed, famous and not so famous, he has there's a real power in his presence that just is palpable. And there's also a tenderness, a gentleness, an ability to laugh easily and to smile, and also to laugh at himself. And that is kind of the physical manifestation of wisdom as I've experienced it.
And we'll leave it there. Krista, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been wonderful to be with you.
Krista Tippett is the Peabody Award-winning host of NPR's On Being. Her new book is called Becoming Wise.
More Wisconsin farmers are looking to spray fertilizer on their fields using a controversial technique called manure irrigation. A UW Extension study issued this week describes ways to reduce health and pollution risks when using boom or gun-like devices to shoot the waste. But as Chuck Kornbach reports, the dispute over the technique may not go away.
One of the farms hoping to use manure irrigation is Pagel's Ponderosa Dairy in rural Kewaunee County. There are 5,000 cows here, some on the loud side. While the cows at this concentrated animal feeding operation, or CAFO, produce a lot of milk, they also create piles and a lagoon full of waste. Owner John Pagel recently won the okay of the Wisconsin DNR to spread manure on some of the 8,000 acres of cropland he owns or rents using what's called a center pivot system. Pagel says this type of spray irrigation has advantages over the more traditional way of spreading manure behind a tractor, including being able to shoot the waste over growing crops in summer.
So we could put it on at low volumes, with low pressure, 4 feet off the ground, and it goes in a circle, and then you can do it again a week later. You got no chance of runoff. The plant takes it up, and you have increased yields.
Pagel also says being able to pipe manure to a pivot system would reduce the number of tanker trucks carrying animal waste on local roads. He says he hopes to start using manure irrigation by June after winning approval from the town of West Kewaunee. Some local governments around the state have put restrictions on the spraying of waste due to fears about pollution and harm to humans and wildlife. But Pagel says he takes an extra precaution. There's so much animal waste at the Ponderosa Dairy that Pagel built this manure digester to generate electricity. He says the digester also kills a lot of tiny disease-causing creatures.
The bacteria, it cooks in there for 21 days, killing the pathogens.
But Pagel and some of the Wisconsin farmers who already use manure irrigation have opposition, including from within the agriculture community. A few miles away from Ponderosa Acres, a smaller farm owned by the Utesh family raises only about 150 cows and some sheep. Lynn Utesh says spraying manure does carry a health risk.
I think what we have to really realize is there is no guarantee of no pathogens, and there are far greater issues than just the water quality and pathogen issue. There's odor issues, there's economic issues for the rest of the community.
Utesh served on the UW Extension panel that released the state and federally funded manure irrigation report this week, but he's trying to distance himself from some of the recommendations. During a webinar on the report, co-editor Becky Larson defended the study.
We really genuinely tried to put as much science-based information and reflect every opinion that we received throughout this process.
UW Extension plans a second webinar on its report. In the meantime, Jody Perrins of Algoma asked the DNR board to halt manure irrigation. Perrins sits on five DNR work groups looking into water pollution in northeastern Wisconsin.
I ask this moratorium stand until a panel of independent medical practitioners are able to conduct comprehensive studies to determine that there is minimal risk to the public's health and welfare.
The board took no immediate action on Perrins' request. A DNR official says his agency is, quote, still digesting the extension report. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.